So I think Benjamin then inviting me to give this talk. So some stuff is a kind of, okay, it's a footnote emphasizing Geoffrey's points and also maybe explaining it from our perspective. But also the question is to actually be clear about what do we mean if you say a theory of quantum gravity, what do we demand? And I'm trying to put up a framework which is quite general, but also geared to spin forms. And it's very much informed by tensor network ideas. In order to basically be clear about what we want, and the need to that is, I could have maybe talked about how to solve quantum gravity. Actually, I did it once. It turns out that somebody, that people claim it, I mean, we know that it already has been solved because there was a paper about it, Quantum Gravity Solved, in the title. So, which means that maybe we are not really clear about it, what it means to have a theory of quantum gravity and what does it mean to solve it. So let's think about what is a theory of quantum gravity and how to construct a theory of quantum gravity. So the point is also to have a formulation, kind of axiomatic formulation that would actually help in constructing a theory of quantum gravity. So the question is, can we come up with a practical procedure? And that was the previous talk, actually. So Wolfgang mentioned these principles. So we have some principles which would basically help us to make sure or not that in the end we have maybe a useful theory which we like. And one is, which is usually mentioned, is background independence. And one could say, do not prefer us saying that we do not prefer a particular metric background. Another important point is ensure independence of auxiliary structures. And for me, it will be mostly choice of discretization, of course. We have to keep in mind, however, that if we do quantum field theory, basically, a very general structure of a quantum field theory is you can extract a vacuum state typically. And so the question is this still possible without preferring a metric background, basically? And is this vacuum state practical? Then there are some other issues, diffeomorphism symmetry. I won't actually talk too much about diffeomorphism symmetry and relational formulation. And this relational formulation will just show up in the sense that we don't really have a scale. And so we have to replace this notion of scale, which is quite fundamental in usual renormalization theory, with something. And it basically, we have to make sure that there's no additional degrees of freedom around which actually serve as a form of ether. And as we know, or you may not know, is that there are formulations of quantum gravity which result in some form of additional degrees of freedom, which give you some kind of ether. And here we need to be careful because the discretization itself can actually serve as a kind of ether and telling you special points of your thing. So one thing what people usually mentioned in this question, what is the theory of quantum gravity? They usually wanted to have something like a quantum representation of diffeomorphism symmetry. And in the canonical formalism, it would be kind of a system of constraints which encodes the symmetry and a consistent constraint algebra. And for years and years and years, we basically failed to have that in four dimensions. I can tell you why is this. I mean, we will see maybe why this is the case, because it actually means that you have a complete solution of your theory. And the question, again, as a part of the motivation, are there better criteria which you can kind of check approximately at least? Because it's very hard to say, okay, constraint algebra is approximately satisfied. You can, but nobody really has done it so far. And we will see that actually constraints are anyway not the right thing to speak about. Yeah?
What about 3D?
I 4D, yeah. Yeah, so I'm seeking for.
What's
your
take on 3D?
It's done in the classical case and not completely in the quantum case. It's done half in a Psi essay, actually. It depends on which, yeah, if you really want to have the hyper deformation. A quantum representation of the diffeomorphism symmetries in 3D? It depends on what you mean. I mean, do you want me to cite all the literature which is related to that? Or? I think it's not completely done as far as my knowledge goes. And in the classical case, we have done it on the discrete level with Valentin, and there's a Psi essay on which is half done on the quantum level. So actually, which shows that the constraint algebra is closed. But it doesn't give you exactly the constraint algebra, as maybe people will do it, but it shows it. I mean, which you knew before, in a sense, but it shows that the hypersurface deformation algebra is closed in the quantum case. Okay. So the challenges are that if you want to be background independent, the problem is that we know quantum field theory best if formulated on a fixed background geometry. And also, if this is fixed background geometry, we usually have a notion of vacuum state. And so in the structure of QFT, usually it is really deeply inside there that you can rewrite a QFT as vacuum plus excitations. If you don't have it in this, you can actually put a construction afterwards, which is called GNS construction, so that you can rewrite it as vacuum plus excitations. So the question is, what is vacuum in this sense? And there are very few non-perturbative methods available to construct QFTs. And one of these few is actually discretization. Okay, and then the next question is, what is a discretization? And we will see it's actually the first step of the renormalization process, actually. And here again, discretization usually is applied or is characterized on a lattice with a lattice scale. So what happens if you don't have a lattice scale? And so what do we do if we think about, let's discretize stuff. What does it mean? So there's one choice which you can say is kinematical, but actually it should be determined by the dynamics, however, at some point. And that's the first relation to Geoffrey's talk. And this is basically the question you have to choose, what observables are described with your discrete theory? And what is the relation of these discrete observables to the continuum? So you can make several choices, and so you can choose a scalar field at, you know, which set of points on a regular lattice, on some other lattice, and so on. You can choose connection variables, that's very cumbersome. You can choose Wilson loops, you know, you can choose some other variables or operators. So this is the first choice you have to do, and as I mentioned, that, you know, in the end, it should be determined by the dynamics, however. And what you then want to do is to describe the dynamics of these observables. And the point, of course, is that you actually reduce from the continuum to the discrete. So you have to have some procedure to approximately at least write the dynamics so that it gives a good approximation to the continuum. Where the question is what does it mean to have a good approximation to the continuum? And we'll come to that in a minute. And so if you're in gravity or if you're, then there's basically, you can give an action principle for the variables you have chosen before. Or you can do Hamiltonian constraints, which is really annoying. I just make this statement, basically, actually to have a consistent Hamiltonian constraints on the discrete level, you actually already need a so-called perfect discretization, And that basically means that you already have solved everything. But this will be coming later. and for the dynamics, basically, indeed, the main question is which discrete observers' degrees of freedom can be described approximately isolated from finite degrees of freedom. And that's where you see that kind of renormalization comes up, because there's a question which variables kind of decouple at least approximately from smaller scales. And so the question is to have a dynamical stability of discrete excitations. and there's a procedure which allows you to find these degrees of freedom, but it would require that you actually know exactly the solution space, which is not often the case. so let's maybe give you one procedure to describe dynamics, which kind of is actually applied in some sense in spin forms. So one way to derive the action for discrete observers is you embed and understand these discrete configurations. As into continuum configurations. And so basically, then given this continuum configurations, it gives you boundary conditions. You find the solution to these boundary conditions in your theory, and you find Hamilton's principal function, which is the action evaluated on the solution for this kind of boundary data. And this gives you, in principle, the action as a function of your discrete data, because you have done the following. You have taken the discrete data, you embedded it into the continuum data, you calculated your boundary solution there, and the point is that you can only calculate the continuum solution if you actually put continuum data, and you get something which depends on your discrete data. And of course, the usefulness of the resulting discrete action depends very much on your choice of embedding the discrete data into the continuum theory. And so let's, for instance, consider three choices. You know, one is a choice, okay, I called it LQG because it's kind of similar to what you do in LQG with the spins. so basically, you choose some points where you say, these are the values of my scalar field. And then I embed it into the continuum by saying all other points, I set the scalar field to zero. I have not tried, but I assume it gives you a very bad approximation to your discrete, that you can compute your discrete action from this. But if you use it to determine the dynamics, it probably will be quite bad. And the reason is that you expect it's highly unstable how this kind of configuration evolves in time, in the continuum, if you can make sense out of it, actually. There's something which works much better, and actually, that's what I explicitly considered. And here you basically say, okay, I have some discrete values of my scalar field, and in between, I approximate the scalar field to be piecewise linear. and so this is usually, if you, for instance, take free dynamics, even free dynamics with massless scalar field, it's only satisfied in very specific regions, basically on triangles, that this is preserved. But usually it's not exactly preserved. But you can use it in an iterative procedure to compute better and better approximations to your discrete dynamics. And if you consider really a free theory, and you consider kind of a regular evolution of your kind of regular slicing, so you just need regular slicing. You can choose on your spatial hypersurface any position of the points, but you need regular slicing. Then you can do the following. I mean, you know that what the solution of your theory are. And you say, OK, my embedding is the following. I have a discrete set of scalar. I have a discrete set of points. These give me some values for the scalar field. I can basically understand this as a continuum configuration, where I match this discrete configuration to one with a continuum with a certain number of modes, where the number of modes is exactly the number of points you have. And of course, in the free theory, the number of modes will not change if you really just look at the regular slicing. And so here you just use actually that you exactly know what are the decoupled degrees of freedom. So this, in this sense, is a perfect embedding. It's kind of a very non-local procedure. You know, you can build it up step by step, but all at once is a Fourier transform, which is the most non-local thing you can, or which is a very non-local thing. And it leads to a so-called perfect discretization, which is defined on the next slide. And you get a non-local action, of course, a priori. Okay, so these are the options, and you see that you get different qualities of approximations with your different choices. And so to make this connection, like the Mera tries to compute something like this perfect embedding. Another strategy which I mentioned is, okay, in case that you know the kind of solutions, just to show you that it's kind of even trivial theories appear non-trivial, is really to decide what kind of solutions do we want to probe. You encode this finite subset of solutions you choose in a finite set of parameters or initial datas, and you find the exact dynamics for these datas. And for a massless scalar field, you pick solutions. I mean, these are the solutions, but you just say that F and G should be piecewise linear. But still, you cannot put it on an arbitrary lattice because you have to take into account and say, I want to be piecewise linear with fixed arbitrary points on my lattice. But you have to take account that now the discontinuities move along null lines. What you can do nicely is to put it on a null lattice and involve it kind of arbitrarily in this null lattice. And interestingly, the action here is also non-local. Of course, now it's, you know, question is of how practical is this procedure is, because the disadvantage is you need to know the solution space. like the frequency stuff was basically related to something which Kempf proposes, but it's different actually in this precise realization. Here has one proposal which is consider configurations or solutions, I'm not so sure actually, with bound on spectra of Dirac and Laplace operators, which is a very nice suggestion, but then it's always a question how to extract dynamics and local physics from that. So it's basically the attention to practicability, of course. Okay. So what is a good discretization? So here we have this notion of perfect discretization, which actually, as far as I know, comes from QCD and the people around Hasenfratz. And the idea is here, okay, if you have this match between observables in the discrete theory and observables in the continuum theory, the condition for the perfect discretization is that observables in the discrete theory coincide with observables in continuum theory. So if I actually speak of, we have to take the continuum limit, I rather mean this perfect discretization. And so if Geoffrey says he can do stuff on a finite lattice, it is actually some kind of perfect discretization. I mean, it's almost perfect discretization in this sense. For quantum gravity, it's really that the perfect discretization requires basically to solve the theory because it's equivalent to a fully effective action. And as we will see, basically we will make more sense of it. The requirement we will have is basically that evaluation of cursor observables do not change if we go to a refined description. Okay, so this is the perfect discretization which you have in the ideal case. Of course, you might not be so ideal usually. And the question is how to describe a good approximation. And of course, it's much easier if you have actually lattice scale or constant, because in this case, you can say things differ in orders of the lattice constant. If you do not have a lattice constant, we have to be a bit more careful to introduce a length scale, which only comes if you maybe have really a semi-classical boundary state which has a length scale. And then you have to compare what the predictions you have from the continuum theory, which you usually don't have, but let's say from a refined theory, for observables which are living at a larger length scale, then the length scale which is induced by the discretization, and induced I mean by the boundary data. So the point is that the boundary, only with boundary data, you have something like a discretization scale. And it's only with the boundary data, if the boundary data are sufficiently semi-classical and peaked on some metric. Before that, it's very hard to speak of any discretization scale. okay, and yeah, it's very hard to say something without any boundary state, because then you don't really have a scale, but you would sum over all geometries in the inside, so your lattice, you sum over all lattice constants in a sense. Okay, so yesterday we had the.
I did not understand what you call a good discretization. Can you summarize?
So here, a good discretization is basically, I mean, a perfect discretization was which would be exactly reproduce everything from the continuum theory.
On the points where.
On the observables which you have chosen. So it could be like fields at a point, but it can be also Wilson loops or any other choice you did.
And you call it perfect because everything is perfect, but why is that useful?
This is basically what we do is we want to describe things in a finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and so discretization, actually, we rather see it as probes of the continuum theory. And so we want to be, you know, you aim always at a perfect discretization in the sense that you say you want to exactly reproduce the continuum physics. So it's useful as an ideal aim.
Okay, but wouldn't you be happy if you can reproduce the continuum in some limit?
And some, yeah. Yeah, so this was the next thing to say. So the problem is in this large distances, to make sense out of large distances in quantum gravity. You know, that's one problem. And indeed, you know, one point is, okay, which I, like for instance, what people usually require, this representation of diffeomorphism symmetry, that would work exactly only at a perfect discretization. You know, things which people are usually not aware of. So here the question is basically, it's this part of what does the theory of quantum gravity mean, to be clear about what we want or what we would aim for. So perfect discretization would be the ideal aim. And indeed the question is to have an approximation scheme to approximate that as effective and as good as possible. You know, so basically here is just a definition of good discretization in the sense that the error you make is vanishing if you take the lattice constant to zero. But then the question is, what happens if you are in quantum gravity and don't have a lattice constant? And then the definition of what you mean with good discretization is harder, because you first have to make sense out of the notion of a lattice constant. And here the suggestion is, okay, if you have boundary data, or a boundary state, and if this boundary state is semi-classical, then you get a scale by, you still have to make lots of choices. You can say you have a curvature scale and so on, and you can compare stuff to this curvature scale. And the other thing is, if you have a discretization of this boundary state, then this metric data also induces a notion of lattice constant for this boundary state. But this lattice constant kind of is state dependent. And then you would kind of apply the usual definition of, at least in the limit that this discretization goes to zero, you get nice results.
What is the significance of having a semi-classical boundary state? Is it that you're trying to compute an amplitude between boundary states, or?
Semi-classical in this case means really I mean later.
I mean the boundary state itself.
What is the condition? Yeah, so this is really that the state should be somehow have a notion of being peaked at matrix at one geometry. Because if it's peaked at 10 different geometries with different scales, okay, then it's a bit hard to make this notion well defined. Okay, yeah.
Say anything more concrete about the last question there, or are you both
talking about this? No, this is an open question for the discussion. Because I don't know. I mean, okay. So how do we treat like discretizations in quantum gravity? So after lots of hard work, one adds up in some form of the partition function, which we had yesterday quite some time. So it's local, and we have some form of amplitudes, which you can imagine as little tensors, just that the contraction is more complicated. And you sum over these things called J, and then, okay, you have some other amplitudes, which are not so important. and so, of course, the question is, what is the status of the theory? Is it fundamental? What do the discrete structures mean? Is this stuff just an auxiliary theory? In this case, you know, auxiliary means it's a discretization. So we have to take the continuum limit. Where continuum limit, I actually mean kind of, I will mean something, in fact, of trying to construct a perfect discretization, as it will turn out. And what does it mean? To take this continuum limit. So this is kind of the covariant formulation. In the canonical formulation, there is a nice input, which I will explain later in more detail, which is known as inductive Hilbert space construction. And this is basically that the idea here is that the Hilbert space of probe states, you have a Hilbert space. I have a family of Hilbert spaces, which include probe states, which are labeled by discrete structures. And you can embed coarser into finer Hilbert spaces. And actually, I'm not so sure where it originally comes from. It might actually come originally from understanding renormalization in quantum field theory. And this allows you to basically define kind of on an abstract level, a continuum Hilbert space. Again, continuum is here just an abstract definition. And to make sense out of stuff, so what you want to do is just to work actually on these finite dimensional or on these Hilbert spaces, which just have some probe states associated with a certain discrete structure. And to make sense out of this and being consistent, that the result should not change under refinement. You have these consistency requirements. And I will explain them in more detail. But these consistency requirements are, again, just the definition of a perfect discretization in some sense. So this is a nice idea, which works nicely on the kinematical level. But the problem for a long time has been to formulate consistently the canonical dynamics. And the problem is to formulate consistently canonical dynamics usually means that you have a representation of your diffeomorphism symmetry. And the diffeomorphism symmetry, in a sense, you can imagine that it actually changes your lattice. It's actually exactly moving your lattice stuff around and moving your lattice points around, especially. And so you can imagine that moving your lattice points around, you probe actually all of your configuration stuff. So basically, to have a consistent constraint, to have consistent constraints means that you need to already know the continuum limit. And that's kind of the essential difficulty in coming up with a consistent formulation of canonical dynamics in terms of the constraints which are supposed to impose these diffeomorphism symmetries. And so that's maybe why to first try to come up with a Hamiltonian formulation with consistent constraints, at least, is a bit like trying to solve the theory and then trying to formulate the formulation of the theory in terms of constraints, because you would need this perfect discretization. And so the question for some time has been how to deal with this situation that we actually have kind of inconsistent constraints. And there were several proposals, which I will not really comment on because it is a separate subject, basically. Okay, yeah?
So, can you say that inconsistent constraints in solving the theory is the same thing? It's not really the same thing, right? For example, in three dimensions, it's not. So as you said, there is a perfect, there's a consistent discretization of the constraints in three dimensions, but it doesn't mean that we have solved even the classical.
Yeah, I'm a bit abstract. So actually, it almost means that in this context in 3D.
This means finding all the manifold features.
Yeah. Okay. So you still have to solve the constraints, but in this sense, is if you have the Hamiltonian, you need if you have the Hamiltonians, you need a consistent family on arbitrary triangulation, on arbitrary coarse triangulations. So for 3D, we can do it because we know it's topological, and we can with lots of work write them down so that everything is consistent. But in 4D, I mean, with solving, having a solution, I mean something that you already have constructed the entire renormalization flow, which will be the point in the end. That basically, you already need the entire family of the H's which Geoffrey has written down to write it consistently on each stuff, and even more because you need it on all kinds of lattices. So basically you need to even know all the beta functions. So in this sense, it's okay. okay, so I think it seems there was some general agreement that spin forms in this formulation are not really fundamental. And indeed, you know, there's basically the problem that diffeomorphism symmetry is not realized. You don't really have constraints, but you have pseudo constraints. You're not invariant under triangulation changes. So there's the problem that you would have to say, what does the triangulation mean? And also there's something. What does it mean if you have basically a discretization, but it comes with very large lengths attached? What does it mean to have these things as boundary states? Maybe more the general problem is that we constructed the amplitudes really in a discretization process. So the general question is, why should we believe in what the discretized theory tells us at small scales? And small scales is something which we don't put in by hand, but it's part of the metric data. So it's basically, you know, you have these amplitudes, they describe you everything. And in this sense, it's rather unlikely that you actually reproduce the UV physics by some miracle. And indeed, what we usually know or what we like about spin forms is that the large scale physics, at least we hope, is nice and reproducing ratchet gravity. So what we don't want to change too much is actually the large scale physics. So the question is, it's a usual question is, what is a good UV completion of gravity? And so the problem is, how can we actually compute it consistently? And that is where we come back to this question, you know, how to formulate and how to solve quantum gravity in the sense is basically indeed how to find the UV completion, which is consistent with the larger scales. And consistent means that doing some kind of renormalization, you regain the large scale physics that you want. So in this sense, construction of amplitudes proceeds rather from infrared to UV instead from UV to infrared. So this has to be taken, of course, on a heuristic level, because in practice you change kind of, you start with some guessed amplitudes and you try to improve them on all scales, but you have to hope that the large scales don't change too much, because that's the stuff which you got from the continuum theory. Then we had this proposal, can we just take the continuum limit in the bulk by basically just refining the bulk discretization and keeping the boundary tree discretization. And so, of course, you can do that, but I think it doesn't really help, or it's not at least the most effective thing if you want to approach an iterative solution to the problem of taking the continuum limit, and this again means to construct a perfect discretization. It's a bit unclear in this formulation. One can think about it, what to require in this formulation from these kind of amplitudes which you get in this context. Does universality hold with respect to all details of the amplitudes? And if not, what do these choices mean? So basically, my main problem is this, that this is not the most effective thing, I think, to do if you really want to find an iterative solution to the problem of constructing amplitudes. Another problem is, okay, you have chosen some kind of boundary states and some kind of boundary discretization, which is some choice of embedding. And the LQG embedding is putting J equal to zero. So it's really putting the degenerate matrix everywhere where you didn't manage to write to specify your boundary state. So the question is, why should this state be preferred? Is it really the simplest to describe dynamics? And the philosophy here is actually exactly the philosophy of Mera, to let the dynamics choose the type of boundary state, because that's exactly what happens in Mera, which indeed should then be connected to having also a vacuum state.
So can you explain to me what that last sentence meant? What you say that Mera chooses the boundary state?
Uh-huh.
Where is the boundary state in Mera?
It's at the end.
At the end. So
it's what you have with the lowest level. It's a boundary, you know, if you say you can get your Mera from your path integral, then the path integral is for us bulk, and the state which you get from this boundary, the rest is a boundary state.
So in which Hilbert space does the boundary state live?
Hmm?
In which Hilbert space?
Oh, in the boundary Hilbert space, when come to that. I'll specify what's the boundary Hilbert space. okay. So this is maybe another sub point. When did I start it actually? Quarter. Okay, that's about summing and saying. No, it's. okay, so we are back to. Let's take spin forms as an approximation and as a first guess to our full dynamics. But then the question is, how do we reconstruct, or how do we construct the full theory of quantum gravity from this first guess? So basically the question is, what properties should the final theory satisfy? And okay, it should be consistent. But we also want to have some practical way to extract predictions. And in the following, I actually consider quantum theory. So the first, in the very first thing, I was actually speaking about classical stuff. So here we speak about quantum things now. So what we want to have is actually having conditions on the amplitudes that can be checked at least approximately without constructing the full result first. And then also to consider the question whether such a theory can actually exist, which also will be much more the open point here. And the main point is to be consistent, and this consistency conditions, again, is a version of these perfect discretizations. So basically, there's two formulations, and there's a boundary formulation and kind of a bulk formulation, and both come with these consistency requirements. And so here is first a summary, and then I explain more in detail actually this formulation. And say how this formulation relates to the boundary formulation. And so this, again, is about, you know, what we want to achieve in the end. So what you want to have is to define the dynamics via something which we call boundary amplitudes. So it's basically we have our boundary Hilbert spaces, and the boundary amplitudes will be functional on this boundary Hilbert space. But these amplitudes should satisfy consistency conditions with respect to this inductive Hilbert structure on this boundary Hilbert space. And I explain on the next slide what this is. And this inductive Hilbert space structure comes with a notion which are embeddings, which are maps from the coarser into the finer Hilbert space. And so here the point is that we allow to change these embeddings in each step, or to speak of general embeddings. So this is just the claim that these also encode the vacuum state. And as I will also explain later, we do not require this gluing principle, which is actually required by the so-called generalized boundary formulation. And it is an important principle in this context to get from amplitudes for simple boundaries to more complicated boundaries, in a sense. on the other hand, so this is a boundary formulation because you basically speak only about amplitudes associated to the boundary Hilbert space. There's a bulk formulation. And so what happens, okay, you have bulk amplitudes. It actually means that you really speak still, you are kind of on a level of the path integral, whereas here you basically integrated out the bulk. Everything which is inductive is kind of exchanged for projective here. And again, I will explain it more detail later. So what happens here is you work on a projective limit of bulk configuration spaces. And the projective limit, I'm not sure I write it down. I can write it down later. again, it's a mathematical way to define formally a continuum limit. But what you want to keep is actually to work with discrete structures in practice. And so to make sure that stuff does not depend on your choice of discrete structure on which you compute stuff, you have a consistency condition. And the consistency condition is on the so-called measure, which is a mathematical term for amplitude. And again, you do not really require the gluing principle, as far as I understood Benjamin. So usually you have non-local amplitudes to have these consistency conditions satisfied. Okay. And I believe that the inductive structures might be much more general than those obtained from the projective structures, but we can discuss this. So here I believe you are basically just in the case where you block variables. And here you can actually also do unitary transformations of these variables. Whereas here, I mean, it's obvious for me how to block variables here, but it's not very clear how to do the field redefinitions. but this is basically one of these open questions. So this is again a more heuristic slide for trying to motivate what is this inductive limit Hilbert space. If you want to have a simple example, again, just take the Fock space and take something like labels which just give you a bound on modes. Have an embedding where you say some, you know, higher modes, you embed lower wave functions which only have lower modes excited into a bigger Hilbert space by setting all higher modes to zero. okay, so basically, again, you want to have a family of Hilbert spaces that carry probe states. And we have to, in general, we have to work in this with this partially ordered family. And for practical purposes, you take in renormalization something which is linearly ordered. So this gives you also a partial ordering of basically the Silbert spaces and into coarser and finer states. You want to have this notion of embedding maps. And this is how to understand coarser states as finer states. So actually, you can take the entire Mera network as an embedding map, actually, and the different Hilbert spaces in the different stages as embedding maps. Mathematically, these embedding maps are actually put in as equivalence relation. And so this explains the consistency conditions you have on inner product observables and amplitudes, because mathematically, it just says that you want to have a well-defined evaluation of observables or amplitudes on these equivalence classes of states. So you have an example. You have a discrete structure, which is given by triangulations. And so you can basically assign variables to these discrete structures. And what you need to choose is embedding of the Hilbert space based on this discretization into finer one and so on. And here you would say that this can carry kind of high complexity wave functions. But if you pull back, there is a way to understand the wave functions here as a subset of wave functions living in this Hilbert space. And so here's a more mathematical definition of what is this inductive Hilbert space is. So we have this partially ordered set of labels, which represent these discrete structures. And you have these Hilbert spaces associated to these labels. there's these embedding maps mapping coarser into finer Hilbert spaces. And they need to satisfy these consistency conditions, which are kind of automatic if you have just a linear order, but can be very non-trivial depending on your embedding maps if we are partially ordered. And then, yeah, that's a mathematician way to write down the Silbert space. So what you do is you define two states with different discretization labels as equivalent if you can eventually fine-grain or embed them to the same state. And this defines the equivalence relation. And then you take the union of all these spaces and the equivalence relation and the closure. So the point is, this is a mathematical abstract stuff, which in practice you never calculate with. So the point is to make sure that you can calculate on these single spaces H alpha, but be consistent about the results. And so this is the notion that observables, which now, of course, live all in the different Hilbert spaces, so observables are again labeled families of observables, this is alpha. They need to be consistent in the sense that they give you the same result if you evaluate it on the state from the same equivalence class. Okay. And you basically require the same from your dynamics, which is the same from your amplitudes. And that's the same thing, just that the observable is now a map which maps from the Hilbert space to the complex numbers. And I've written it in a slightly unusual way that basically this is actually the transition amplitude, but I just summarize it into one boundary Hilbert space, which is a tensor product of top and down. So this is maybe this point which I'm not sure I explained further. It's basically that if you start with an initial discretization, which is the empty set, you can interpret the resulting amplitudes as giving you the vacuum wave function, or giving you one notion of vacuum wave function. And this is a simplified version of the Hartle-Hawking no-boundary proposal. And that's kind of the relation to having a notion of vacuum, which of physical vacuum, which comes with that. So how to express the continuum dynamics in terms of these discrete structures is basically, okay, we have given this family of embeddings, and we kept them arbitrary, so far we kept them arbitrarily. And if you want to give the dynamics, I claim this is equivalent to giving you the amplitudes as functionals on each of these Hilbert spaces. But there is a condition on this family of amplitudes, which is if I go to this very complex Hilbert space and take my amplitude functional here, but I choose a state which comes from a very coarse Hilbert space here, then I get the same number as if I would just take the same state here and take the amplitude functional for the low complexity Hilbert space. And so the axiomatic definition now is basically that a complete family of consistent amplitudes, so if I really can actually take here the inductive limit of Hilbert spaces, defines a theory of quantum gravity, where theory is kind of the definition which apparently Reuter uses, which means it corresponds to a complete renormalization trajectory with scale given by the complexity parameter.
Yeah, you've been talking about having consistent but in your examples you seem to have a sequence of coprenics that are, there is a total order, right?
Mm-hmm.
But are you considering also partial order?
Yeah, the partial order will be...
Okay, so your drawing is only, it's a total order, but...
In the example, I...
But you have in mind like partial order.
Yeah, yeah. Eventually. Okay, and the question is, you know, can one actually take this? I mean, that's one of these open questions. And can one think about, are there arguments for the existence of such a complete family, or counter arguments for existence for such a complete family? And of course, that is kind of part of really solving quantum gravity in the sense that, you know, usually, for instance, a subset of people claims you can couple arbitrary matter. But in fact, if you require these things, then one would hope that it also gets restrictions on what kind of matter you can really couple here in this question to really reconstruct a complete family of these amplitudes, which actually, as I will explain now, means to later to reconstruct all the beta functions if you also consider matter coupling. So why don't we require the gluing principle, which is required in, so that's in Oeckel's generalized boundary formulation. So to give a context, Oeckel's generalized boundary formulation is exactly saying that he formulates theory by saying I associate amplitudes to boundaries, but he requires this gluing principle, which says if I take the amplitudes associated to two regions and glue them in the sense of integrating over the boundary data here, I get the amplitudes for the bigger region. And in quantum gravity, it doesn't, again, make much sense to speak of bigger regions. So it's, if you are in the discrete, it would mean to take amplitude for more complicated boundary states. You can construct them from gluing from amplitudes for less complicated boundary states. However, if you really want to reconstruct or have that as kind of in a sense of perfect reproduction of continuum theory, usually this will not work if you just take a discrete, an integration over discrete data here, because you cannot be sure a priori that even if you put a discretization here, it will not produce data which don't fit into your discretization which you have chosen here. So basically this gluing principle in general cannot, I mean, if you are keeping everything general, it cannot hold in the discrete. So you can only formulate it, can hope that it holds if you take the continuum limit here for this gluing. And so that's a bit harder to formulate axiomatically. And so that's why we don't require it on the discrete level. Okay, so here is actually the translation into terms which people are more used to. And this gives you the bulk formulation and the relation to the Wilson renormalization flow. So you choose, so now you are in the bulk and you choose configuration variables X, and let's denote by C alpha a configuration space based on a bulk discretization alpha. So for instance, the graph which Benjamin had inserted in your bulk manifold. And in general, you can also allow for a boundary, and so have also parts of this graph living on the boundary. Before we had injections, so now what we have is projections. So we need a family of these projection maps, mapping from, finer to coarser, so there should not be a prime here. And I didn't give, so these projection maps have to satisfy a similar consistency condition as embedding maps, so that doing two projections, it's the same as doing the projection at once, and so on. So let's assume you can actually, you find a family of amplitudes which satisfies the following relation, which is here, let's say the Wilson, which happens to be exactly the Wilsonian renormalization flow condition. And what you have to realize is that these projections are basically the blocking functions. Because you say that what you do is you integrate over all finer variables x prime, which project to x. You know, so it's a choice of coarse graining. And so you integrate over all these x prime over all finer variables, which give you the coarse grained variables x. So x can be, for instance, the sum of four spins. And you say you integrate over all combination of four spins, which give you this sum of four spins to be equal to one or four or whatever. And you define this family of amplitude in this way, or actually, you, by some miracle, you manage to already construct this family of amplitudes in this way. And this is exactly the Wilsonian renormalization flow. And here is basically the condition which you would have on these amplitudes if they would not come from this thing to be cylindrically consistent. Is that any observable you evaluate by taking the expectation value with respect to this amplitude or with this measure gives you the same result if you evaluate it on the coarser level. Of course, you can only require that for coarse observables. So here you have one choice of observable which you can represent on your discretization alpha. And you calculate the expectation value of this observable in two ways. You calculate it on the coarser level with your coarser amplitudes, and you calculate it on the finer level with your finer amplitudes. And to make sense out of this coarser observable in this finer discretization, you need to apply the projection map to the arguments here.
Can I just comment on that? I mean, on this slide, seems to look like that choosing the projections as the blocking functions is an essential ingredient, but in fact it isn't. So that is one choice that one can make,
yeah.
But it's not necessarily the only one.
Yeah, no, so you can formulate it with arbitrary blocking functions. The question is, what is a good choice in the end to construct? Yeah, this I'm not sure how to put it into the pies, but we can discuss it later. okay. Indeed, so this is just now you can basically derive from this, or you have this consistent bike formulation, and we have seen that this basically requires a Wilsonian renormalized, basically the renormalization trajectory of your amplitudes. So if we take the previous condition and we go actually to a manifold with boundary, we can choose as observables the boundary wave functions. And what we had as a condition for cylindrical consistent measure for the observables, if you put now the boundary wave function, we get this following expression. This just the same expression. And we can integrate out the bulk variables. And we end up with this combination where we basically had something very similar. So now we have this boundary amplitudes acting as a functional on our boundary states. And on the coarser level, and here on the left, we have our finer boundary amplitudes acting on our technically the finer boundary state. And here you can basically read off the definition of finer boundary state. This gives you a consistent amplitude conditions in terms of boundary states if we construct our embeddings as the pullback of projections. Okay, so that's the point. And indeed, mathematically, so you can get from every projection, you can get an embedding. if you speak of blocking, indeed, you would have to find a way. I think what you would have to do is not only speak of this blocking, but also allow these field redefinitions, which then would be kind of a slight generalization explicitly. And the question would be how to do the same, like find conditions or find a optimization procedure for finding these things. Okay. So mathematically, I'm not sure they are still in this projections, whatever they are, which is just a claim that we know a number of projection maps and embedding maps. So the question is embeddings, you know, what is more general? I mean, embeddings can be derived from projections. Can all projections be derived from embedding maps? And as a comment, technically, I don't even know how to derive the BF embedding, which is still a very simple embedding, because that would actually require to have this flux representation and non-commutative stuff happening. So that's kind of maybe not so easy to write. Okay. So far in this formulation, you can take arbitrary embeddings.
I know, but
the question indeed is what kind of embeddings do you have to choose in this iterative procedure to compute most effectively this family of amplitudes? And I have the last. I have the last slides on this, and this last slide is a local version. I mean, it's actually just motivating what Geoffrey told us.
Yeah.
in the case where you have a local element, and in the case where we are in gravity, where we don't have a local element.
No, in gravity we have local amplitude. You start with local amplitudes.
Yes.
Question is of
we have local amplitudes.
We start with local. This is the starting point of the construction.
So what's the optimization procedure in the case of gravity?
It would be, I mean, the question. This question is in general open. But Geoffrey's procedure, for instance, gives you one possibility.
Yeah, but Geoffrey has a specific Hamiltonian that they can use to optimize.
Yeah, he starts in the TNR procedure. He starts with specific amplitudes. Gravity gives me specific amplitudes. The specific amplitudes, they also give me Hamiltonian. Indeed, it's a question whether everything converges in the end. But it's a question. I mean,
I was going to ask you a question. So yeah. When you say, I mean, you've been discussing this in a very abstract way, but are you thinking of specific amplitudes that replace this A?
Yeah, no, the spin form amplitudes. You know, and that's what we basically did in first in 2D, and now we're trying in 3D to show that these procedures converge.
You don't have a notion of what amplitude, in the sense that
there is the initial amplitudes I showed you. They are local.
So the connectivity in the graph, is it local?
This is completely local. You can write it in a tensor model form. I mean, you can write, you know, it's a more complicated procedure, but you can also write it in the usual tensor network form. And it's with just local connect nearest neighbor interaction. So the starting point is this local formulation. The point is that this local formulation is a question whether you should understand it as fundamental. And the main point is it cannot be fundamental.
There is another difference that the spin we use is some buffer and goes from 0 to infinity. So there's no short product in this. There is weird.
Yeah, so.
The fact that the spin is capped.
So. First of all,
so if your eye is infinite dimensional.
So can I say something? First of all, you can, for instance, I mean, I have an exercise that I can, for instance, formulate scalar field theory even in the discrete, and deal with infinite integrations.
That is fine. You could have harmonic oscillators.
Yeah, which it was a free scalar field, but then you can talk about perturbations around it. So I can show you the calculation. You can do this stuff, first of all.
So this would correspond to infinite tensors with infinite coefficients, infinitely many coefficients. But then if you have some way of addressing those.
So it means that then you need something semi-analytical techniques. So if you can make sense out of that and put it up, it means that it's much harder or basically impossible to put it up numerically, or you find some way to make a mixture of that. And we had a structure which we called decorated tensor networks, which might allow for semi-analytic techniques, a mixture between using numerics and analytical calculations. So that's the first point. The other point is you can take quantum groups.
About that, because you explained that very clearly, that when you do the numerical implementation, you have to choose low spin and then get to the next spin. And then, you know, they know from the next spin to the next spin. So
first, if he speaks about this bond dimension, it's not spin. It's a completely general variable, which in the example of a free scalar field, these variables, you know, Geoffrey speaks of local. It's actually what he writes is a Fourier transform. So it means that what you try to find is a truncation so that you find the relevant degrees of freedom. So it's not equal spins. That's the first point. It's not always an infinite sum. Of course, you expect that in the end you have to sum infinite to infinity. But indeed, the aim is to extract a truncation where you can do stuff with finite dimensional things, which is something similar to Fourier transform. And Fourier transform for a field, you manage it with finite stuff and have a perfect. Yeah, no, indeed, it's the, all the MELA stuff is about finding the best truncation, finding the best boundary states
when
in this truncation.
You mean the local language of freedom or in the space? The political form of your local language of freedom.
This, yeah, in, I mean, Fourier transform in the sense that if I want to have this perfect discretization, for example, I block first, I can do a Fourier transform in space.
Oh,
okay. You know, and I believe if you do your MELA for a free field theory, then in the end.
Yeah, then in general, you lose locality.
But it's kind of, you do kind of bit Fourier transformations and steps. Which is kind of, White gives this talk about the wavelets, which is a bit similar. Kind of,
For free theories. Yeah.
For free series,
right.
You know, and the point is that if you're interacting, we don't know, and so we have to do some optimization procedure or something. Be ingenious to guess what are the best truncations. So, okay. So basically, So I'm saying it's not hopeless, and we are trying, and but the entire procedure is something like finding the best boundary states, and that's my point about refining the boundary. this is just to make the connection to the first point I had, that we have seen basically that in the end, the amplitudes we have give you really the renormalization flow. And so they should encode the running of the coupling constants. And what we usually, what I've seen is that if you naively discretize, you put some gravity part and maybe there's some coupling constant hidden there, but then you write a coupling constant, they have the meta part, and you put it on your discretization. And so, what you should be able to extract if you manage to have at least some version or some approximation to these amplitudes, to these consistent amplitudes, is then again in a local approximation to extract a running coupling in the sense that the coupling constant should indeed depend on the geometry put on your discretization. And of course, you know, it's a question to compute it for non-trivial examples in a gravity background, and then go and get your prize or something. And Benjamin had a simple example, which is almost topological, which is a 2D gauge theory where you can indeed extract the running of this coupling, which goes with the area from this consistency conditions. So this again is an extremely abstract level. This is to just now make the connection to the first thing I said, because gravity, quantum gravity solved was a paper about canonical theory. So in principle, once you have the consistent amplitudes, you can derive the canonical dynamics in terms of constraints. And if you are completely consistent and everything works nicely, then the constraints indeed should give you the consistent constraint algebra. And the consistent constraint algebra, if you see that as a hyper, if you see that as a spatial hypersurface, it should move your hypersurface. And here I've of course just written it in the simplest way that it moves it in a very regular way. But in quantum gravity, we have all these constraints which generate all possible movements of this hypersurface. And then we want to have a certain constraint algebra to be satisfied. This is more for the experts to say that from this condition, you can actually derive the operator which generates this hypersurface movement. And it's basically the hope that an idea generalizes which was applied to 3D and to the derivation of the Hamiltonian there. And that means that the Hamiltonian should be also derived from the family of amplitudes which encode the renormalization flow. So of course, then in the Hamiltonian, you should also the running couplings. And so solving quantum gravity, if you understand us, solving quantum gravity, writing a consistent set of constrained Hamiltonians, it includes to solve all the beta functions of your meta couplings. And just to say that, you know, if you try it to write constraints by some other principle, is that one has to be prepared to also solve these questions. Okay. Do you believe that this version is just a version of Geoffrey? Because it is just saying here. So then I can. So the practical implementation part of that is Geoffrey's talk. And you can motivate that with more abstract stuff, but it's basically indeed summarizing the kind of the ideas which I think are in the background of this. Maybe to explain the summary, I should indeed explain this thing. It's really that once you require the consistency of these boundary amplitudes, it's indeed the condition that which is written here, that the finer amplitudes evaluated on states which you get by embeddings are equal to the coarser amplitudes. But a priori, this condition will not be satisfied. But then you can actually take a guess for the finer amplitudes. You take your preferred embeddings, which in this case are actually constructed, proposed to be also given by the amplitudes themselves. Using a feature which we have in quantum gravity that we can easily describe dynamics from finer to coarser and coarser to finer structures. And so you can actually calculate this thing, and what you define as improved amplitude is basically the left-hand side. And so what you do is to construct a coarser amplitude from finer data. So here you take basically some finer data, both in the bulk and in the discretization, to compute a coarser amplitude. And given some choices of the discretization you deal with, this is basically some choices equivalent to choosing your bond dimension, you can iterate this procedure. And it's completely iterative, and the fixed point equation will then satisfy this consistency condition for these two sets of discretizations. And then, of course, the question is to repeat this with a finer discretization to compute again a coarser amplitude, which then is postulated to give an even better approximation to this coarser amplitude. And you repeat and see how this converges with taking this amplitude, taking this procedure to be finer and finer. And so this procedure basically takes the condition we had on cylindrical consistency and uses this in an iterative procedure. And the point is really that also the boundary states are changed. And that seems to be kind of the most effective way to use fully the iterative solution of your theory. That's basically that. This is very abstract, but indeed the problem is always to come up with a prescription which you can implement. We formulated what is a theory of quantum gravity, and we said, okay, it's this family of cylindrically consistent amplitudes which we want to obtain. But using this condition, we can actually try to attack this question, how to construct the theory of quantum gravity. And that's basically taking these conditions and iteratively improve the amplitudes so that they satisfy the conditions.
For any kind of tensor model, you find this simply, then you can change it as a pure probability, you can be sure. Because it's so general here that I could use any type of tensor model. So is there any sense you're going to end up with many pure probabilities?
No, of course, there are many questions. The question is if spinform models are worth anything, then in this procedure, you hope they should converge to something consistent. And I didn't mention a notion of diffeomorphic symmetry, which, let me think. So at some point, so basically, there are several points. One is to use regular lattices, which is to do this stuff in practice, which, again, we justified basically by first showing that in some easy examples it works to take regular lattices. It's justified from the point of view that you believe that the first approximation should have some notion of being invariant at least under slight changes of the triangulation and should be invariant under slight, have at least some approximate notion of diffeomorphic symmetry. And we showed that these notions are also kind of very much related to each other. So assuming you can actually regain triangulation invariance, you can actually prove, you can prove that you get also diffeomorphism invariance.
But are you equating?
And diffeomorphism invariants?
Yeah. So
we have an argument that triangulation invariance implies diffeomorphism invariance.
By triangulation invariance, you don't mean invariance on the platinum, it's something more general.
I mean, in this context, I mean triangulation invariance under Pachner moves.
That leads to topological invariance.
No, so what I didn't mention enough is that Benjamin's formulation is completely non-local. It's not completely non-local, but the amplitudes, to have amplitudes, which in interacting series, which satisfy the cylindrical consistency, they are non-local in general.
Okay. Yeah, and I thought you want some kind of locality to implement the RG.
Yeah. So as you know, you can start with if you do arbitrary blocking. If you start with local amplitudes, you block, you get something non-local. Mm-hmm. I gave you perfect discretization with the Fourier transformation, it's non-local. Mm-hmm. So there's different notions of locality, and the question is, there's locality in the discretization, which is completely something different than locality in the continuum theory. So the perfect discretization of a local continuum theory is non-local. It's local in the sense that the couplings are exponentially decaying, but as a discrete theory in itself is non-local. So you need to think carefully about your notion of locality in this sense. So the formulation in the bulk is non-local in the sense that if you want to improve your theory, you indeed need more non-local structures. As we have also shown with Sebastian about this measure in the Ratchet calculus. And indeed, the practical improvement of tensor networks is basically that with this boundary formulation, what you do is to introduce more and more variables by basically going to more and more complicated boundary states. So increasing the bond dimension is the same as increasing the complexity of our boundary Hilbert space. And this allows you to talk about the amplitude for one building block, which, however, can have an arbitrary complicated boundary. So it's like introducing changing higher derivatives into more fields.
Okay, but to go back to this default environment, so you say, okay, once you reach that, you have theories which are default environments. But presumably there's a large
spectra of such theories. So which one would be gravitational versus, I mean, is there, you know...
Is there a large spectra? There are lots of uniqueness theorems which say if you manage to preserve, I mean, which is basically if you manage to preserve locality in the sense that in the continuum you just have second order derivatives and you have diffeomorphism invariants, then as far as I remember, there are only two theories satisfying these conditions.
Yeah.
No, indeed. This is a question. I cannot guarantee. I mean, somebody constructed the spin four models. I don't know who.
Maybe the question is what is different then? Because you keep referring to deep phase. He has many different continuum. I mean, depending on the models, there are many different physical models that flows and stabilize. Whereas here, you're saying what I expect to have only one phase.
Yeah, so there's a difference in philosophy in the point that Geoffrey says, I take my lattice model, and this is my lattice model, and I want to take this renormalization, and, I mean, the fundamental model is really the lattice model in this sense. What I'm rather saying is, I take the procedure, something similar related to Geoffrey stuff, to hope to be able to construct my family of amplitudes.
Yes, but you can only add things to it, because in my construction there was no mention of gravity, and I would like to understand what it is that you are. I mean, for instance, at some point you said, I'm doing this with amplitudes coming from spin networks. Yeah?
From spin forms, yeah.
From spin forms.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah.
So
basically in your TNR, you start with some tensor model, which you get from the Ising model.
Yeah.
I start from my tensor network model, which comes from the spin form amplitudes.
Mm-hmm. Where the input from gravity was only provided when you specify the object that you are constructing.
Yeah.
So the whole formalism is very general.
Yeah.
And then you turn it into quantum gravity. Quantum gravity seems to still require concrete input into the whole formalism.
Yeah, no, so you start with these concrete amplitudes which you get from, for instance, spin four models. Then the question is, okay, does the procedure actually converge? Does it converge on different lattices? You know, so then the question is, can you construct actually this family or an approximation of this family of these consistent amplitudes? And of course, in the end is the question, do these amplitudes still satisfy the semi-classical limit? Which I made this point in the beginning, you rather wish that kind of in the entire changing of the amplitudes condition, you don't want that the property of the semi-classical limit of spin forms, which seems to work to a certain degree nicely, to be completely lost. So you actually, this is what I'm saying, what you kind of want to achieve is reconstructing, is kind of finding the UV completion, which is consistent with the infrared, and consistent meaning that indeed you want to get make sense of coarse graining your small scale stuff to get your large scale stuff. Just that in quantum gravity we cannot easily say we coarse grain small scale stuff.
It seems then that you may want to add something to what we do with the Ising model. You may
mm-hmm.
want to add not just the initial material that you are coarse graining, which
mm-hmm.
would be a spin form,
mm-hmm.
but you want to add some rules that guarantee that certain properties are preserved.
Yeah, so basically, okay.
Some way of explicitly enforcing that the constraints are preserved.
Yeah, no, this is, I mean, it depends on which, so indeed, what I rather want to find important is to keep actually all these unitary transformations you do. So I need to keep them explicitly because they are the embedding maps.
Right.
So we're just kind of really relating the observables in the continuum, in these different things.
You can undo the constraint, so you can find it anything.
So basically that's one thing you want to keep.
But there is a lot of freedom in this unitary transformation.
Yeah.
So the question is whether there is a way of encoding these additional properties
that you want
in a theory of quantum.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's this one almost trivial thing is that, which is to put stuff to to preserve the gauge symmetry, which is not diffeomorphic symmetry, but this.
That one, yes, that can be done.
That can be done. It's actually already non-trivial, but
sure.
We hope that this can be done. And it's harder to speak of diffeomorphic symmetry, because the point is that the initial amplitudes don't satisfy diffeomorphic symmetry.
Voice.
I mean, that's the entire thing. If they would satisfy diffeomorphic symmetry, that would be already my nice theory. So they break diffeomorphic symmetry, and it's really, and the stuff which we what we showed in an example is actually that basically the fixed point conditions, I mean the fixed point conditions being the conditions to have this consistent family of observables, if everything works out, diffeomorphic symmetry is only realized at this fixed point of the construction. It's an emergent symmetry you want to have for the entire thing. And so indeed the entire difficulty is that diffeomorphic symmetry, you want to have it emergent on this continuum formulation. How to make sure that, I mean, how to help it to emerge? Okay, so it's an interesting question, you know, and indeed, you know, you can think of, I mean, what the most general thing is, something which has been found in classical ratchet calculus is that it only emerges if you have kind of regular triangulations. So, you know, you need to subdivide and refine stuff so that the simply says in the induced matrix are kind of half a regular or fat. Like these conditions, but how to ensure it is a very open field. So
I guess the additional input would be to come up with a notion of what is an approximate notion of default symmetry in the lattice, so that you use it in your optimization process. But of course, the difficulty of quantum gravity is that we know what default symmetry is, but we don't know what is a good notion of approximate default symmetry, and that's.
Right. So, yeah, even, so if your lattice procedure, if your containing procedure is generating and it's realizing this diffeomorphism invariant in an emerging way, you have to detect design mechanisms to detect that this is happening.
You're getting towards it, and that's the biggest problem.
The generations of the Hessian matrix, and if that becomes smaller and smaller in the limit.
Yeah.
So
maybe to say something in ratchet calculus, there's this condition basically that the Hessian and some linearization around that indeed has eigenmodes. And indeed there's one condition which is that the amplitudes have to serve as projectors. So if sometimes Laurent asks about what ensures that things converge, so that there's actually a large part which should be projected out, which are actually all the gauge non-invariant stuff with respect to the diffeomorphic symmetry. So technically, it was Nielsen which kind of formulated this idea. Indeed, the additional degrees of freedom which you get by violating diffeomorphic symmetry, you know, it's kind of a gauge symmetry, so if you violate it, you get additional degrees of freedom. And the hope he had was they are kind of short scale entangled and in a continuum limit or via coarse graining, they would be thrown out. But he considered this question back then and had lots of reasons to be, to not know or be skeptical how it can be really recovered, because diffeomorphic symmetry is also non-compact group and all these things. So. There's one mechanism, which is that diffeomorphic symmetry, because it's non-compact, is related to more divergences. And so actually there's the only mechanism, there's this mechanism you can hope for, that sitting on the most divergent part means automatically you emphasize a part which carries a notion of symmetry or approximate notion of symmetry.
There's another way to talk about this, is simply by considering lots and lots of different discretizations. I mean, if you just think of these discretizations as discretizations of manifolds, then at least a boundary diffeomorphism acts on that discretization by changing it around. And both of these have a common refinement, so both of these have to satisfy certain conditions by these consistent boundary conditions. So there's an equation with these iota. So both of these have to embed into the same finding. And that is a condition.
Yeah. Well, there's physically, there's first the task, okay, to do something practical with the given regular stuff, and then to actually extend it to more irregular stuff. But so far, our problem was always practicability and to do something. I mean, you can require lots of me, but as you know, it's always a problem to do first something, to do the first steps, and then to do the next steps to improve what we have done in terms of calculations, what we can do so far. So we can theorize more now. But indeed, it's more.
At some point, because I guess
it's also to see what is actually possible. At some point. Okay.
Why you listen?
Having this as a last statement, I would ask you to refer all further questions to the speaker for lunch break, and thank you, Anka, again.